This is the Liminalist, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley, and this is the second part of a conversation I had with Heather Tracy. Some of this material may be disturbing, as it concerns Heather's childhood experiences of sexual abuse and some extreme imagery.
It wasn't until later that he told me about murdering Grey Horse, how it was my responsibility that that had happened, and how this monument was the physical representation of the ruin of our connection.
So when did he tell you that?
Probably within 3 or 4 months of my arrival back in Washington and re-establishing our relationship.
So during those 18 months, and how did those 18 months come to an end? What happened?
I grew so unable to tolerate the levels of fear that I decided that even though it felt as though I was signing my own death warrant, I had to evict him from my life. I was sure beyond it. I was absolutely convinced that he would murder me in retaliation, but that was preferable to the suspense. So I wrote him a letter giving him a time frame and indicating that if he hadn't removed himself and all of his things by a certain date, that I would take legal action. And I retreated to a home of a friend that I was pretty sure he wasn't aware of, and I hid for about a week. And when I reemerged and dared to come home, he was gone, and the majority of his things were gone. And there were a few stalking incidents over the next couple of months, but at one point I approached him in public when he'd been following me, and I had a meltdown. I grabbed him by the lapels and I threw him against a wall, and I screamed at him that I would kill him if he ever came close to me again, and then I walked away. And that was the very last time I ever saw him.
What year was that?
Oh, good question. 1980, 84, 85. I wasn't yet 21, but it was close.
And the incidents you wrote down in your notes about what he did to your dogs and the other threats, all of that was in that 18-month period?
Correct.
And his relationship with, when he told you about his relationship with Volkovich, that was also during that period?
Yes, it was.
And that was like in the quality of bragging and veiled threats, or what was the context for him bragging about his relationship with Volkovich?
It wasn't bragging. It was, even though he had sort of publicly disavowed me, meaning I had assumed the role of servant and was no longer privy to the inner circle, when we were alone together, when he wasn't raging, he would often explain that I was the only human being who knew him. So there would be these confessional monologues that he would share with me. In what seemed like an effort to disburden himself of his own toxic load, while at the same time sort of attempting to explain himself philosophically to the one person who might understand. And so he found it important to share with me this philosophy that he had developed. And this is where I began to experience the truth of his hidden life, which had begun with the atrocities he'd experienced as a child. The fact that his first sexual experience was jacking off over the font in his Catholic church to a vision of the Virgin Mary. His admiration of and aspiration to the kind of ultimate transgressionism represented by Vukovich's courage, this is how he framed it, in killing his mother with an axe and subsequently having sex with her corpse. Jim found that to be admirable and I don't even know how to describe it. It was so clear when he was saying these things to me, he wasn't bragging, he was explaining. And he was explaining in a way that made it clear that he felt he was speaking to someone who had sympathy with this point of view, who was on board with the program.
Which by this point, I'm guessing that you weren't.
That is correct. It was all I could do to stay as small and silent and still and unthreatening as possible during these episodes so that he wouldn't kill me. He would be pacing up and down the room, making enormous gestures with his arms and legs and speaking very, very loudly and very, very quickly. And I would be curled up in a chair in the corner, enduring.
And in your notes, you mentioned him. He made a similar threat to you, like what he would do with you, do to you, was similar to what Vukovich did to his mother. Is that right?
Right, because he saw that as being transcendent, and this. He didn't speak to me about it as though it were a threat, Jason. He was, again, speaking to me as though I got it and would be on board with the program. He presented this to me as, oh, yes, and by the way, I have friends who can arrange for me to legally have access to your corpse once you're dead, and that would be an opportunity for me to experiment with this realm of experience that would include having sexual relations with your corpse in ways that are considered abominations. He wasn't like holding me down and glaring into my eyes and threatening me with this. He was explaining it to me as though it made sense.
Did it ever? I mean, was there ever times where it did make any kind of sense to you at all?
No. I recognized that he had decided long ago that he could not exist in this world in a way that had anything to do with nurturing and love. And he had decided that the way of a brujo was appropriate for him, and that he had gifts in that area, and that through destruction and sacrifice and dismemberment and transgressive sexuality, he would be attaining individuation.
Right.
So I recognized that that was his point of view, but it was not something that called to me.
Did he ever talk about Aleister Crowley?
Not that I'm aware of, but I was unaware of Crowley myself until after the year 2000, I would say. However, he certainly spoke of De Sade.
Right.
Although I didn't experience him as a sexual sadist, I have no doubt that he expressed that elsewhere, perhaps with other children. Here's why I say that. I mentioned to you that his best friend took me in for a few months when there was this big blow up breach where my family forbade me from seeing Jim, and there was a physical altercation with my stepfather, and I was removed from the home temporarily. Well, that best friend of his, this is the same man who talked him down from the standoff with the rifle in the cabin back when he was a teenager, had gone on to marry and have a couple of kids. And one of those kids was a young man that was probably 3 years younger than I was. And he felt to me like the closest thing I'd ever had to a brother. I loved him. He was hilarious. He was brave. He was odd. He was delightful. I loved this boy. I lost touch with him after I sent Jim away in my late teens. But he and Jim continued to have a mentor-mentee relationship for a few years. In preparing for this talk with you, I thought I'd see if I could find any information about this companion of my childhood to see how he had fared. Evidently, he's a performance artist who calls himself Ardent Vane. And the only performance of which I can find any record online is where he's covered in blood and assuming the persona of some character from a graphic novel called Cannibal Fuckface. Now, to me, that feels like a literal embodiment of Jim's aspirations. To eat human flesh, to be covered with blood, to be unashamedly transgressional in all that horror.
Right.
So what happened to him? I don't know. But it looks like it's embedded in his flesh.
How are you feeling talking through all of this?
I'm feeling determined. That's I was dreading doing this, thinking that it would be overwhelmingly emotional. And it has the potential to be that for me, but I made a decision that I felt like it was important to have this conversation in a public venue. Yes, for my own personal reasons, but also perhaps to help us locate this pattern of behavior in a wider context. And I feel determined to go through with that. I think that's much more important than any personal story.
So, okay, so you are determined, and you've been, yes, you have been very focused throughout this conversation. But has stuff been coming up for you physically or emotionally that you've felt that you're having to contain or suppress?
Surprisingly, not as much as I would have anticipated, but yes, of course, I'm experiencing waves of physical agitation that then peak and calm down and arise again, depending on the sensitivity of the memory that I'm accessing. Yeah.
So, and right now, do you feel agitated?
No. Right now, I feel solid.
That's good.
It's very surprising to me.
So one of the things you said you wanted to do to prepare for this conversation was read Vice of Kings. Did you finish it?
I did finish it.
Okay. Was there anything in there? And obviously I don't want you to feel you've got to try and sum up anything or be comprehensive here, but was there anything specific about reading it that you found meaningful or helpful in the context of what we're talking about today?
Absolutely. I think one of the first things that dawned on me as I was working my way through the first half of the book was, it seems to me unmistakable correlation now, but I wasn't aware of it consciously before, between the methodology of Fabianism and the individual pedophilic grooming process.
Can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. It seems painfully obvious to me now, but it wasn't at the time. The Fabian adherence to gradualism, to incremental, quote unquote, painless change echoes perfectly, you know, a practiced child rapist's ability to insinuate themselves, make themselves indispensable, become more and more helpful over time. And only once a certain amount of dependency has been transferred to that person do they slip it in. So I found that very striking. I also felt, whether this is appropriate or not, I felt very familiar with your description of being a young person in this greater socio-political intellectual maelstrom of which you're largely unaware, and yet there were all these points of intersection everywhere you turned. So that things like the not so distant connections to organized crime, to occult circles, always just perhaps one remove away from your direct conscious experience. That just echoes so much of my own history.
Right.
That sense of context of powerful, how do I put this? I'm making waving gestures with my hands to describe this flow that I sense around your family, through your family, and around my family, and through my family. There's nothing very explicit about it, and yet, everywhere I turn, there's some little connection that's off, disturbing, suspect, feels unclean somehow.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, well, what you described, the correlation you made between the Fabianism and the pedophile grooming made me think of a virus, or so it enters and slowly takes over the organism little by little, so that by the time the organism notices, it's too late. And also how that the wolf in sheep's clothing thing seems to relate to that as well. Like, how does a virus access an organism by appearing to be benign, or by Trojan horsing it, you know, by riding in on something that the organism is ingesting as if it were benign, and then it gradually reveals itself. So it's like the Fabian methodology is like the pedophile thing. It's a wolf, but it's got the sheep's clothing, and it has to introduce itself into the system, into the target psyche, incrementally, in a way that appears benign but gradually reveals itself as something else, but without us really ever recognizing that it's not benign. So by the time the wolf is fully revealed, we're so consumed already that we still see the wolf as benign, even though we no longer can fool ourselves that it's a sheep.
Yes,
because we've been turned into it. We've been devoured by it.
That was exactly what I was going to say, because, you know, what comes up for me as I hear that description, and I find it so accurate, is that line from, I don't even remember which book it is, one of the Castaneda books, where he's describing the flyers and how their ultimate colonization of us was so successful because they gave us their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels to me as though the predatory consciousness in my personal lived experience, in addition to perhaps a culture-wide traumatic experience, is one of having been given that mind.
Mm-hmm.
Under the guise of nurturing.
Right, a sort of tough love nurturing, even. I mean, the more it reveals its nature, the more it becomes a sort of tough love thing of, this is what you need in order to survive, this is what you need in order to become who you are, like the higher level individuation through transgression, transformation through trauma. In order to survive in a predatory universe, which is what Castaneda, you know, believed, and the flyer mind is all about that, how the universe itself is predatory, we have to well, he never overtly says become predators, but we certainly have to develop strategies and behaviors that prevent us from being prey. That seems like that's an age-old trick, isn't it? It's like the only way to beat this is to become it.
That's the mythology, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. That's the pattern.
How it spreads. That's how the virus replicates itself. And it becomes self-fulfilling. I mean, I think Castaneda truly genuinely believed that we're living in a predatory universe, energetically speaking, not just in the natural world, that everything is predatory. And there is an argument to be made. I mean, Castaneda's stuff is very convincing.
Oh, yeah.
But it's also self-fulfilling, because the more you believe that, the more you're going to interact with with existence in that way, the more you're going to reinforce that experience or intensify that experience and evoke those kind of responses from existence, because our perception becomes distorted in that way. I think it's probably accurate to say it's a distortion.
I think that there is a neutral source of energy. This is the conclusion I reached a few days after ejecting Jim from my life. That I knew him to be a powerful manipulator of energy, and it was very tempting for me to believe that the universe itself was predatory. That's how, certainly how it felt. But I realized that he was channeling a neutral energy in a specific way that corrupted it, but that that energy is not inherently predatory. It simply is. It simply is.
I think I would go even further and say that that energy is inherently loving and benign.
I want to believe that. I'll settle for neutral.
Say hello to Boundary County if you make it up that way. I don't get around as much as I did in my younger days. I was raised in that country, so pure and so fair. But I took too hard to the whiskey and wandered away from there. Wandered away from there. I miss the barbed wire and the sage on that wild northern range. The giant staring sky like a bright tragic blue eye. Why I left, I can't say why. I can't say why. Are a one-way try, I never make it back. I never make it back. I miss those violet hills and the sweet smell of the fields. Reach their arms out so wide, like heaven's only bride. Why I left, I can't say why. I can't say why. Every man serves his time. I know I've done my share. When that old roll is called, I don't get around as much as I did in my younger days. In my younger days.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, because I think Castaneda, I think that was the beginning of Castaneda's, or the foundation of his philosophy, that ended up being a predatory one, that it's neutral, like there is no benevolence to the universe, it's just entirely neutral. But because of that, there's some, the natural kind of order of things is predatory, because I'm not sure why he would go ahead.
Neutrality is devoid of love.
Because it's devoid of love, essentially, yeah. So if a parent, if a caregiver is neutral to the child, it can just then start to use the child just for purely pragmatic purposes. So it's like spiritual Darwinism, I guess, is what you get at the end of it.
That makes sense. To me, the idea of a neutral energy that had been misused was a step up from where I had been.
Sure.
But I can certainly see that that interpretation is open to utilitarian functions that are almost always not benign.
Right.
Right.
So I think there's something inherent, like if it's entirely neutral, the rationale would be, well, I can use it any way I want.
Well, I think we can.
Not without distorting it. It's like the life force, right? The life force isn't neutral because it wants to move towards life and express itself in its true essence, which is joyous and loving and benign, because it's the life force. Okay, these aren't moral qualities; they're not social values, and they can become that, and so then that becomes. That itself can be a distortion if we want to restrict the life force to our idea of what benign or loving is with our own traumatized minds and so on. And so you can see how it can become all very entangled. But was I trying to express that if the life force is inherently, does have an inherent quality to it, then the attempt to use it in a certain way that is adverse to that would then distort it and corrupt it, just as you have a child. You know, a child is inherently open to life and inherently curious and inherently, I mean, it's created to receive and give love. That's the primary modality of a child. It needs love and it has love to give. So as soon as that gets, hijacked, then the love starts to express itself in the opposite way. So it's never really neutral, is it, within that?
I'm reminded in ways I can't really articulate, but that I know you'll be able to help me with, of your discussion of light in relationship to darkness. And we're not looking at two opposing forces. We're looking at energies that are different in kind.
Well, there's an absence in the presence, isn't there? I
Right.
mean, darkness is merely the absence of light, however that comes about. It's obviously very complicated to think about, but the same with love, I'd say, that the negative manifestations of that we're talking about here in abuse relate to an absence of love. It's not present to leaven our perceptions and our behaviors and so on. And again, it's like it's not neutral. We're born into this world in a way that simply isn't neutral. Like we're born with specific needs. An infant can't be neutral about whether it receives love or kindness or care or food or not. It's impossible, right?
Right,
And
those are
so
imperatives.
those are absolute imperatives. And a parent essentially can't be neutral about its child. I think neutrality is probably, and this is again is in Castaneda, and because I emulated it, and there are many ways I could talk about parallels I've seen in what you've told me today, but I've held back for a number of reasons. But one of the appeals of Castaneda was that was this cold, ruthless perspective. It felt very empowering to me and liberating. And I used to rationalize that as like, well, that's because it's true and the truth is liberating. And I think there was something healthy in it insofar as I was trying to get free of the sort of hallmark enmeshment, distorted, suffocating version of love in quotes, the counterfeit that we're all grown up. We're all surrounded by the counterfeit of love and compassion and all that that isn't really true. It's just human egos, it's just the sheep's clothing for the wolf. I wanted to get free of that, and so Castaneda's perspective about being cold and ruthless was very, very appealing to me, and about transcending all human concerns and all of that. But and that was central to that was a neutrality, just having this dispassionate, neutral gaze that the universe supposedly has for us. But I now think, and as we're talking about it, that makes sense that that would be a very safe place for a traumatized psyche, or a safe mode for a traumatized psyche to take, because neutrality would provide relief. That's detachment, essentially.
Yeah, what's that? I find that fascinating. I think that as I'm listening to you say that, I'm beginning to have a more cautious feeling toward the concept of neutrality. It's so funny to me that I can, find myself at this age and still be surprised by this simple statement that, the life force is reaching toward the light. Somehow my perceptions have been so distorted that feels revelatory.
Well, that seems like a good thing. I mean, not that you would have been so shut down that you would need it to be revelatory, but that it is revelatory suggests that it's a deeper, more visceral experience rather than an intellectual one, because you're aware that intellectually there's nothing revelatory about that, but for a life force that hasn't ever experienced that, or doesn't remember having experienced it, then that would be true revelation. And it can be apocalyptic, of course, to play right into that word. And I suppose that's a very core thing, like the apocalyptic perspective. Seems like itself is a symptom of trauma, the inability to experience the life force simply as being a natural orientation, towards goodness, we have to experience it in a way that is revelatory, and that the revelation can itself be overwhelming. So then, and that kind of, that would perpetuate the split, potentially. Like, if the only way we can experience the life force is apocalyptically, which is the dark side of the revelation. I know the words, the words have the same meaning, so I don't want to get tangled up in the words, but again, it seems to be this orientation towards the darkness that you've described today, that the only way we can really reclaim our souls is through an apocalyptic process, which is true, but because we're so cut off from experience, we create a mind-generated version of that, and hence we have an apocalyptic experience that is, like in the Bible, apocalyptic. You know, it's not just a gentle revelation of who we are, it's this massive confrontation with Satan and all the forces of darkness, and that somehow is going to lead to our liberation. And well, I don't know if I believe that anymore. Like I went that path, and so maybe I had to go through it, and maybe you had to go through that, and it certainly does present an opportunity to integrate consciously something that's very, very dark, and thereby turn the apocalypse into revelation. See what I mean? Like, turn something that's traumatic into something that's healing. So I think that is, it's weird, because I think that you or I, by emerging gradually out the other end of this experience, somehow it's like we complete and resolve the pathology that caused our own trauma, that somebody like Jim, they were trying to bring it about, or Castaneda were trying to engineer it for themselves, you know, but they were doing it in a way that was, you know, they condemned themselves, and yet we're the evidence that possibly that it can be used for healing an experience of the dark.
That's fascinating. As though in all of Jim's striving to reach some Nietzschean transcendental state, he accidentally, and just as a byproduct, created what could be a real opportunity in someone else's life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's a scary idea, isn't it? Because it could justify, you know, his own rationalizations, or their own rationalizations, or Crowley's, or Castaneda's, all these rationalizations. That was why I asked if it ever made sense to you when he was ranting in this way about individuation through ultimate transgression, because that's what I tried to get to with Vice of Kings. Well, what if Crowley really was truly aspiring to something, and that what he was aspiring to is the same thing that I'm aspiring to, essentially, which is knowledge of reality and union with God, or however, you know, we're going to term it, you know, the highest sort of aspiration, essentially. But he went about it in, you know, pathological ways. So I was trying to allow for was that, even despite all of that, what was it possible that something good could come out of that? And I felt I had to do that to do justice to the subject matter, but also for myself to, oh gosh, it's very difficult to say, you know, describe, but it's like, it's kind of like once there are mountains and then there are no mountains and then there are mountains again, you know? Once there's no trauma, and then there's trauma, and then there's no trauma. Like, so the rationalizations I had that I believed in, Castaneda, Crowley, all that stuff, turns out they were just coping mechanisms for trauma and spiritualizations and of, you know, trauma imprints. And so then I have to dissolve them and get clear of that. But once they're dissolved, it becomes very paradoxical because in a certain sense they become true. I don't know how to put it really, but I suppose it is about integrating the trauma, that once it's integrated it's the life force and it's like the trauma never happened.
Yes. I know I still have my own desert of trauma effects to resolve. And there's something so much larger to this context, to what Crowley, what Jim, what Castaneda, what you, what I have sought. And there's been a lot of blood spilled. Wow, my hand just started shaking uncontrollably.
That's wrong, left or right.
There's been a lot of blood spilled. There have been a lot of shattered children. And it doesn't have to be all devastation. There's more here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's more to it.
Which hand is shaking, by the way?
My right hand.
Are you right-handed?
I am. That's very unusual. I don't often have somatic effects like that.
Well, one of the things I mentioned that I was coming up for me, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to talk about it, and I'm still not. I can always edit this, and I don't want to go into detail either. But when you described the way Jim was with you, and even some of the specifics, I could see myself in that. Like I had a relationship when I was in my mid-30s with a very young girl. She was like six. She was six when I met her, and she was a cousin. And I felt like I fell in love with her in a way. And we just had a very close friendship. And I guess, you know, I was something of a father figure for her, but I also was kind of an older brother. And, you know, I was arrested development myself. And anyway, I found a lot of solace in this relationship. And one of the things, you know, resonated with what you were talking about there was you know, disturbingly similar to the relationship I had with the six-year-old for about 6 years or so, up until she was around 12, was the whole thing of magic. Like, because she was a young girl, she was still in a realm, a sort of magical realm of believing in fairies and all that. And I, in my 30s, I was still immersed in Castaneda stuff, so I also believed in fairies and in organic beings and magic and all that. And so the two worlds kind of meshed quite well. And and this was true with my niece also, who's this is how I knew this other girl, because it was a friend, well, it was my niece's cousin, and they were also close friends. it was also there in my relationship with my niece that, you know, my sense of magic and my kind of relative innocence, and this was also sexually, I was quite innocent sexually in many ways, but certainly socially, meant that I was really able to relate to where they were at as children, and to be with them in a way that they didn't get to experience being with other adults generally. And also for me, it was something very special about that I was able to kind of explore and express my nature in a way that I wasn't in any other kind of relationship. And I'm pretty sure I thought about giving this girl Castaneda when she was old enough, 11 or 12. So that, and if I had, I would have given her Journey to Ixalan, because that's the one that I always recommend that people start with, because the first couple of books are harder to get into. And so, although I don't think I actually did it, just the possibility that I might have done, and then the larger context of that relationship, even though it never was sexual, and there was never anything, I don't think there was anything destructive in that, although, of course, I have to acknowledge that my own unconscious is, you know, that we affect and impact one another unconsciously as well. So what was going on in my unconscious, by definition, I wasn't aware of at the time, and now I am aware that there was stuff in my unconscious, that I was seeking something in that relationship that pedophiles seek within children, like a sense of innocence, a sense of safety, a sense of intimacy that was non-threatening, and so on, right? So there was that going on there, even though it never became overt. And actually, later in my life, that became a clue to me that probably something happened to me as a child, because somehow I found it so safe and reassuring to be in a very loving, almost romantic relationship with a child in my 30s. That was like, well, that's a red flag, you know. If generally speaking, if somebody has that orientation even a little bit, there's you know, a good chance that something in their own past happened. So yeah, eventually I had to look back at that time and think, well, actually there was probably something in my unconscious there that was trying to play out. Unfortunately, it didn't play out in any destructive ways, but it was still the tip of an iceberg that you could see in a case like you describe, where it really does become overt and destructive, because the individual in question is much more unconscious, let's say, and is giving in to the pathological drives. But it's not either or, like you say. There was a benign aspect to your relationship with Jim, and the way that, from what you described, he wasn't just using the kind of magical enchantment of witchcraft and of specialness to lure you. It was something he genuinely believed and wanted to transmit to you.
Correct. We were sharing a reality that was obscure to others, is how it right. felt.
Right.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to offer you my gratitude for your willingness to describe your own experience so vulnerably. Thank you.
You're welcome. So I think it's an example of how these sorts of drives and these sorts of agendas exist and unfold on a spectrum in such a way that, like, my tendency when I'm talking to you today, and in general when I'm exploring these subjects, is to want to somehow eventually get to some sort of solid social reality of, oh, so do you think he was connected to the networks, and do you think he was part of this and part of that, And does this confirm what I've been trying to confirm, that, you know, the world is configured in this way, that there's this hidden superculture, you know, that whole big picture narrative that I am exploring in Vice of Kings and other works, and that so many people are trying to uncover. That's my tendency, is to want to try and confirm that rather than simply let it remain in this sort of liminal space where you know that you were a victim of abuse and manipulation and grooming and all the rest of it, and that it was embedded in a culture that was to some degree complicit with it, without really ever being sure that, you know, I mean, I'm assuming at this point that you can't be 100% sure that Jim was part of any network of organized child abuse. Is that right?
That's extremely accurate. I mean, the entire context of this relationship is fraught with a kind of implication. There's an implication that something intentional and perhaps conspiratorial was taking place. And yet, I don't know that to be true. And I'm not willing to assume that it's true. I'm trying to just sit with what I know to be true, which is this level of ambiguity, the nurturing coupled together with the horror all bundled up in friendship with magical overtones that are both sinister and delightful.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't reach any conclusions, but I will acknowledge that there are many breadcrumbs that indicate that if Jim was not connected to such a ring, he would have welcomed that kind of association if it had been available to him.
Yes, that certainly seems clear. And he was quite successful as an artist. I mean, we didn't even get to that. Like, there was a New Yorker article about him in 1991. So he became somewhat established as an artist.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So it seems, I mean, this is where I was at with my brother. Like, it's almost like if you get two oil bubbles close enough together, they merge into one, but they have to, you know, as long as there's enough space between them, you're never quite sure. But and same with Crowley, like,
right,
if there are, we know that there are these networks where it's the norm to commit these acts, that's the hidden culture, and we know that Jim, and in my case I'm pretty sure my brother, would have ended up, you know, participating in that if he'd had access. So then the question then becomes, well, was he at a level where he was likely to have gained access? And in my case, I mean, I have to say, yes, I think he was. You know, he was friends with Stephen Fry. Not saying that Stephen Fry is a pedophile, but there's quite a lot of clues around that. The whole thing with the Groucho Club, and very, you know, the various different things suggest that my brother, and not to mention his celebrity, suggest that he would have been close enough to have been invited to those parties.
Right. It was very difficult reading that portion of your book and just witnessing the same ambiguity that I struggle with and have struggled with for so many years. The overlap between what is probable, what's possible, what has been demonstrated as the outer limit of behavior to which this person is willing to go. In both of our cases, that other demonstrated Crowley, in writing, your brother verbally to you, and Jim verbally to me, that virtually there was no limit to the atrocity to which they aspired. Did that translate?
It did.
Yeah.
Let me just a quick question about Jim, because of what I knew about my brother. Did Jim have a kind and compassionate side?
Absolutely.
Hmm.
He was the nurturer in my childhood. I had never experienced warmth, caring, compassion on such a level before.
And you feel that it was genuine, not just a simulation.
Oh, or, absolutely. Yeah. When you were describing the relationship that you had with that young girl, and the main feeling I got from that was an overwhelming tenderness. That was how I experienced his presence in my life until the day that he started inserting body parts into me.
Right.
And even after that day, he still continued to assume the role of protector, nurturer, parent, in the absence of any of those energies elsewhere in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I do know that he loved me, but, and it also had absolutely demonic overtones at a certain point.
Yeah, it's very confusing, because that's,
yes,
where my mind goes with my brother is when you said capable of anything, and I agree, there's evidence to suggest that, a willingness to try anything,
right.
But I also saw another side of him where he recalled in horror when I described being cruel to an animal and like expressed real tenderness in ways that would suggest that he was too sensitive to possibly do things like that. Right?
Well, I guess my response to that would be, I think that both things are true. I think the man that I knew as Jim Acord was in fact my savior, my nurturer, my father, my mother, my best friend, and side by side with that, in a split universe, he's dancing with human intestines roped around his neck in exaltation.
Yikes. I mean, because it's very archetypal as well, isn't it? Like the gods that have, you know, light and dark faces.
Well, what else are we to... I don't know how to metabolize the reality that we're discussing, which is tenderness and atrocity in the same body, both of which are genuine.
Yeah.
Floating round the
world on the wind.
Yeah, I don't know either, and but I do know that, or I do feel that no amount of tenderness can erase the atrocity. While even the smallest atrocity erases the tenderness. And I don't know if that's right, or if it should be that way. Maybe it's an error to want to try and judge a human being at all. I mean, certainly that's the religious perspective, judge not lest you be judged. And maybe this is, because actually I feel as though I was getting to this from a different angle when I was talking about the desire to know if something is organized or coordinated or not, the traumatization, if it's part of a group organization and a methodology, or if it's happening more randomly and organically, that desire may actually be futile and also unnecessary or erroneous, because it's not either or. Like, well, I feel as though what I was describing in Vice of Kings and what you've described today is that there's a culture in which behaviors are, I suppose it's a top-down thing, like a culture that is configured and ruled over and kind of internally managed by perpetrators of these behaviors and groups that perpetrate these methodologies. It bleeds into the whole culture. It bleeds into every single psyche and every single life. And so then you have a spectrum between those who are doing it fully consciously and in a fully organized way, you know, as part of a, you know, shared complicity, and those who are simply possessed by those same ideologies or those same methodologies or those same traumas, and therefore acting it out unconsciously. And that's a very wide spectrum, all the way from what we imagine about, you know, high level organized child trafficking and abuse, maybe even in a ritualistic setting or MK Ultra or these kinds of programs, to the wife, the mother that sticks a clothing pin on her child's penis. Well, of course that might be organized too, but assuming that if that was just, you know, somebody, she was possessed by Catholic fears and beliefs and all the rest of it, acting out her own trauma, a combination of their own trauma in her psyche that she wasn't able to integrate or, you know, fully consciously address, with the ideology that she was raised with, that diabolical combination of trauma and ideology, or trauma and beliefs that then become justifications for the further traumatic reenactments, then you have, that's the spectrum, isn't it? From people who are consciously taking the path of transgression in some twisted and distorted attempt to become whole, to people who are just unconsciously possessed by more seemingly benign ideologies, whether it's movie love or whether it's religion or whether it's reading too much Castaneda or whatever it is, but still, you know, possessed, driven by the same traumas or similar traumas.
Yes. And the fact that the term possession seems like the only honest descriptor feels very powerful to me, that there's something very bedrock about this understanding. Not that I understand, but that I often had the sensation when in Jim's presence that he was in fact possessed by a consciousness different than his ordinary day-to-day consciousness that felt familiar and comforting to me. But that a spirit of ferocious, brutal, lascivious violence would replace everything else familiar about him for temporary periods. It would arise and subside. And there was a taboo against discussing or referring to these episodes once they had passed. They were not to be acknowledged. Did you feel anything similar with your brother, or was did he not have those episodes of loss of control around you?
Not anything like what you're describing, although I can certainly, in my own life, I can point to episodes where I've lost control in that way, so it seems highly likely that he was like that in more intimate circumstances. But certainly, my brother could shift from seeming very vulnerable and tender and loving to being ruthlessly condemnatory, bullying, and without much of a, you know, without kind of batting an eye, not that it would happen, you know, often, but essentially if I just said the wrong thing, he could switch from Jekyll to Hyde. Absolutely. But it wasn't that he would start raging or ranting. He didn't act it out in extreme ways, but his attitude towards me would go from seeming very humble, loving, open, gentle, considerate, to being absolutely
vicious.
Viciously condemning, yeah. Yeah, but that when that happened, then, and this happened repeatedly, it happened three or four times anyway in the last few years of his life, he just cut off all communications with me. So that was, it wasn't a question of we won't talk about it, it was we won't talk about anything anymore. I'm not, you know, I don't have time for, he once said to me, I don't have time for falling out with people, which was his way of falling out with me, as in, you know, I'm not even going to talk about why I'm not going to talk to you anymore.
So he would simply sever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was a control method. I mean, knowing that the axe could fall at any time meant, of course, I was very careful about what I said to him.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
I did want to add a couple of pieces of data that may or may not be relevant. One is that I think it was on my 11th birthday, but I can't be sure. Jim presented me with a piece of jewelry that he had created, and he made a point of telling me that it was one of 13 of these pieces. And that it was the 13th. It was a necklace, a choker on a leather band that was a silver cat's claw. And it's difficult for me to describe, but obviously a particular cat that had once been alive had been dissected to the point that this claw and the base of it and the tissue in which it's embedded at the bottom of a cat's foot had been cast. It wasn't a sculpture that someone had created. It was a life casting.
Right.
It was presented to me as a sacred thing. About the same time, he, and as I said, he made a point of telling me that it was one of 13 and that this was the 13th and it had great mystical significance, but I remember nothing else about it. Except that it felt both honoring and creepy.
And did you wonder where the other 12 had gone?
Yes, I did wonder, and I didn't see them appearing on any of the people in the circles that I was familiar with. But I had a conscious acknowledgement that at least it felt to me as though he was saying, I am part of a coven, you are part of a coven, and this is the symbol of that connection. Those words were not used, but that was how I understood it.
And you wore the necklace?
Oh, yes, I wore it.
But you didn't ever ask him about the other 12?
No, I didn't.
You mentioned there was a couple of things. Was there another one?
Well, this may or may not be relevant, but it's one of those odd occurrences that feel as though they have significance. Whether that's grandiosity on my part, I have no idea. So I'll present it to you and we'll just let it sit there. I was in, I think it was sixth grade when this was going on. I'm not sure. But at night, Jim would crawl in the window of my bedroom and stay with me for hours and then leave just before dawn, sometimes as many as five nights a week. And then I would get up and get ready for school and get on the bus and go participate in middle school. I remember one day a girl from a different class approached me, and this was someone I was frightened of. She frightened me. I perceived her as a witch. I don't know why, but that was my understanding. I saw this girl. She was a witch. I better stay away. She was scary. Well, we had never spoken, to my knowledge. But she approached me between classes in the hallway at school. And she came very close to me physically and looked into my eyes and said something like, "We're expecting you tonight. You better fucking be there." And then she turned and walked away. And I remember consciously feeling bewildered and shocked and frightened, and I had no idea what she was talking about, but it was very disturbing. I went on about my day, went to class, did what I did, went home, and as far as I know, had an undisturbed night where Jim didn't show up, and I actually slept through the night. Got up the next day and returned to middle school. And again, this girl approached me. And this time when she spoke to me, she looked into my eyes with this knowing complicity, this amused, mischievous wantonness that indicated that we shared a wicked secret. And she said something like, "Well, it's a good thing you showed up." And then she walked away. And I never spoke to her again.
She was the same. No, she was older.
She was a couple of years older. She was like maybe 14, you know. She was a goddess.
Why was she a goddess?
Because she had this menacing aura of power.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I was terrified of her.
Huh.
I can't even tell you why. I just was.
So, I mean, specifically around that, but also generally, do you feel that there's missing pieces in your recall of your past that would make a lot more sense of it if you could reclaim them?
I'd have to say the answer to that is yes. There are enormous gaps in my conscious recall of not only my early childhood, but also intermittent body areas of vacancy throughout my young life. A lot of that could be attributed to drug use and alcohol. And perhaps that's all there is to it. I don't know. But there has been this odd taint of the occult around the edges of much of what I remember, Jason, and it bothers me. For instance, at one time in the early 70s, my mother, my stepfather, and I lived in a tiny town in the Santa Clara Mountains of California called Aptos. This is a few miles inland from the California coast. And it's roughly part of the perhaps sphere of influence of people who might have had connections to the Manson family or the Process Church of the Final Judgment, or any one of the occultic hippie commune style organizations that were so busy in that area at that time. We didn't live in this place for very long. We were living in a trailer in this tiny little town until one afternoon I came home from school to find a rubber chicken impaled on our front door by a pair of scissors. And I thought it was funny. I thought it was creepy. I thought it was very weird. I didn't understand what it meant, but I knew it must mean something. So when my mom came home from work, and she saw it as she came in the house because I hadn't touched it. I asked her about it. And she said something like, "Oh, I've pissed off one of the witches around here and they want to get rid of me." And I wasn't allowed to ask anything else. She insisted it was unimportant. But we also moved within a month and we're gone. That happens to be, I'm not saying it's related, but it happened to take place at roughly the same time that Kemper, who lived in Aptos, was active. And it just feels uncomfortable to me. Like, I'm more disjointed in my feeling and my consciousness right now, and more uncomfortable in my body than I have been during the entire conversation.
Interesting. I was going to mention Kemper earlier because of Vukovic, the similarities between those murders. Like Kemper also had sex with his mother's body, didn't he? Or
Right.
his head, or her head, I think it actually was. But anyway, yeah. So, and the possibility again that Kemper and many of these killers are not acting independently, that they're part of some larger unfolding in culture.
I'm persuaded that that's true. And there are things that I've revealed to you about Jim that lead me to believe that even if he wasn't a full conscious participant in some kind of larger organized ring, I think it's very likely that his time incarcerated in Northern State Hospital in Washington State may have been an opportunity for him to at least be an experimental subject in either an MK Ultra or a sub program run from some kind of alphabet agency source, interested in exploiting traumatized individuals and exploring their utility. And the reason that I say that is because there's a particular story by Anne Diamond where she recounts a confession that she received from an acquaintance where he and another person were quote unquote programmed to perform a particular kind of atrocity in a particular setting in conjunction with their training. And Jim described exactly the same atrocity in the same setting as something that he had done with a companion shortly after leaving Northern State.
What was it? What was the atrocity?
He and his friend had picked up a young woman. Evidently, she was in her 20s. And they had abducted her, taken her to a cabin in the woods. They had restrained her physically and taken turns burning her vulva with cigarettes.
Wow, so that wasn't on my podcast with Anne Diamond then. That was why I asked, because I thought I would have already heard it, but no, I haven't heard that account.
I guess I must have encountered that on her site when I was probably reading the thread about Leonard Cohen. Leonard Cohen was a big deal in my mom's life.
I guess I'm going to put a trigger warning at the start of this podcast, but make special warning for the end, I suppose, because we, yes, that's very disturbing.
So I never learned more about the context for this story, but and I didn't know what to do with it at all. I mean, except contain it, right? That's my job, is to contain these things and not splatter them everywhere. Until I came across Anne Diamond's account of the exact same thing. But this was carried out, you know, in Quebec or Ontario, as opposed to Washington State. But followed the exact same pattern. And so that felt really uncomfortable.
I'm sure.
It doesn't seem like the kind of behavior that just spontaneously arises between a couple of lads out having fun during a weekend.
So when you mentioned containment, I asked you earlier, you know, how you're feeling talking about this stuff. How do you feel now, and how do you feel about making this public? And I don't just mean how do you feel emotionally, but do you have any concerns about, well, I suppose there's various things out there that's possible. Reprisals could be a concern, but also do you have any concerns about the possible negative effects of talking about this, that it can actually somehow be counterproductive to bring attention to these things? Do you have any concerns around that or anything else?
Thank you for asking. Um, Yes, of course, I have concerns. I've been hiding for a very long time. And I'm done with that. So, whatever, there's still a large contingent of Jim Acord hangers-on, admirers out there. If this happens to come across their notice, it's possible that, they could lawyer up and attempt to create problems for myself or for you, and I'm not comfortable with that. So I guess my preference would be that perhaps we not name him, at least use his last name, or it will omit that, just so you're not in a position to catch any unpleasantness in a legal way. But other than that, I feel like I'm such small fish in the world. There's no reason for me to be concerned that somebody's going to come get me.
Yeah, I mean, but there are many layers and levels, aren't there? And many different sorts of reprisals, even from your own, from one's own psyche, there can be reprisals for speaking out.
I'm willing to risk that. I feel like I need to risk that.
Well, I'm not concerned about legal action. I mean, I think there was a little bit of a tizzy around Ann Diamond and Leonard Cohen, but I certainly never got threatened with legal action. I just got one of Cohen's lawyers trolling my website for a while, or I forget even what his job was, but he was definitely trolling. And this is much smaller fish, so I'm not concerned about that. My concern is more that the context is right, and that by airing this, it can facilitate healing, not just for you and for me, but for people who listen to it, and that it's a bit of an either-or thing now, though I suppose it's a spectrum like everything. But I mean, if it could, I think material of this kind, if it doesn't help people with their own healing, then it probably makes things worse, you know. Because it's just,
I
yeah.
do know, and that's a policy that I at least attempt to implement in my own life. Meaning, I take my role as a container seriously, and I think that it's important to not just uncork the bottle heedlessly, but that it's also important to do it in a conscious effort to shed light. And perhaps, I don't know, I don't know, but to discuss these things is important.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen. These words are yours.
know they all come from long ago and only resonate now. But it's hard to tell which thoughts are my own when I keep hearing everyone else. I keep hearing everyone else. I won't listen. Some point they become the family of one.